taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore feminist issues in the punk music scene.
Lawsuits designed to stifle citizen activism.
A tour of a bird rescue center.
Thoughts from recent college graduates about social consciousness.
Satire.
And more. First, 22-year-old Matt Ward. Matt's a punk.
My girlfriend considers me a punk. A lot of people label me, and I think I've been called punk for so many years by other people that I've started to believe it myself or something.
Right now, Matt's going to tell us a bit about the skinhead movement's family tree. He's been known to shave his own head in the past. He spends a lot of time fighting the common misperception that all skinheads are racists. They're not.
Just an example of education, there was one guy who's a big skinhead guy who's very much not racist. He's just a neutral skinhead. He's not like two-tone, which is basically, you know, anti-racist. And I was just giving an example because he had the black flight jacket with the American flag on the side. And I said, well, look at, you know, a lot of people don't understand. And for example, that's what you're wearing with the black flight jacket with the American front, or the American flag on the side, is American front uniform. And I know you're not racist because I know you. I said, this guy's name is Ian. I said, you know, Ian, I know you're not racist, but a lot of people will perceive that. And I didn't tell him, like, to take it off, but the next day it was gone. You know, I think he realized, you know, and that's the kind of thing where, you know, that's a positive thing. You know, another thing I noticed him and another skinhead doing is that they were wearing Fishbone t-shirts. And Fishbone's this L.A., a black L.A. kind of a ska punk band. And the skinhead movement started out with being white kids from England who went to these ska shows. And it still survived. That part of the skinhead culture is called two-tone. And basically, it was white kids that shaved their heads and, you know, went to ska shows. And, you know, it was interesting because these kids started wearing Fishbone t-shirts, and Fishbone is associated with this. It's like a statement saying, I'm not racist, to the people in the know. In the kind of more undefined skinhead culture, there's this attitude of being loyal to other skinheads, you know. And obviously, if you've got one group that's specifically anti-racist and one group that's specifically racist, you can have problems. But in between, you might have a skinhead who's not racist who will defend a skinhead who is racist, you know. And I don't mean like an anti-racist skinhead, because that's a whole other thing. I mean, you could divide them into racists and non-racists and anti-racists. And the anti-racists will actually attack the, you know, they're militantly violent against racist skinheads, and so that's a whole different thing. The best way to combat fascism is whenever, you know, fascists start getting together and having meetings or demonstrations, is to get as many people together and confront them, to embarrass them, to let them know that they're not liked. It's sad, you know, because you are talking about young kids, and I can understand you if you're some young runaway girl and you end up in Bremerton, and these guys are, you know, you're white, and these big guys are like, well, you know, we'll take care of you if you become one of us, and, you know, and they tell you what their version of life is, which is basically, you know, the blacks and the Jews and the homosexuals and the, you know, cause all the problems, and they're the responsible for all the pain and suffering in society. And if you're not very well educated, you could accept that, you know. But it's the same thing where, you know, if these kids had, you know, if they had, you know, good family lives, if they had lives, you know, that they probably wouldn't need to be drawn to this, you know. And the thing is that they could move here. A lot of people that have had tendencies that way, like to be Nazis, they move here and they realize, well, here's this whole other culture that's a lot larger and a lot more positive and isn't, you know, involved with hating, you know, hating the government or something, but not just the you know, people of other races.
You're listening to a feminist punk rock band called Bikini Kill. In the past, punk rock and feminism haven't had much to do with one another, but there's a new movement afoot. Women in the alternative music scene are finding they often share common concerns. Judith Samuels contributed to Earth on the Air this personal exploration into the girl scene.
I haven't been a part of the punk rock scene for a long time. I used to go to a lot of punk shows in the early 80s. I loved the environment, inspired music, slam dancing, and an atmosphere filled with electric energy. But I slowly lost my enthusiasm for the alternative music scene as my lesbian feminist sensibility grew stronger. None of the bands that were part of the underground music scene at that time seemed to have anything to offer me. It was a boy scene, boy bands singing about their alienation from society. As a dyke, it didn't mean much to me. But right from the start of last month's International Pop Underground Convention in Olympia, Washington, there were strong women's voices coming through. This was something I hadn't anticipated. Women usually aren't invited up on stage to talk about sexism or sexual assault. Yet here was a group of women doing just that. They were forging a place for women in the underground music scene. Kathleen Hanna is a writer of prose, a poet, and lead singer and lyricist for the band Bikini Kill, who you just listened to. The strongest theme in Kathleen's writings is sexual abuse. This is Kathleen performing spoken word prose on a 7-inch record of wordcore poetry that was just released.
The real rock star lives on. Incest is best, he says into the microphone. Big black hair hung over his left eye, like a pouty little girl child, a sexy skinny little girl man child he is. Inspired by nothing but air, a stale feet sound, a muffled daddy voice inside of him. You can do better, boy. Incest is best. Put your sister to the test, he says into the microphone. I'm in the audience. I want to scream so bad. I hate him. I want to scream, but I know if I do, the boy next to me is going to say, aw, come on, he wasn't meaning no harm. You take things much too seriously.
Kathleen says no one talks to her much about the main theme in her songs, sexual abuse, and she says that some men have a real problem with the subject matter.
I hear comments about she's trying to be political. I'm too into the sexism thing, you know, and I'm really interested in the place where social work and punk rock meet, because I see punk rock as being this incredible forum for, you know, punk rock like originally was like a real class movement, and I want to be a part of like a similar punk rock movement of sexual abuse victims, survivors. You know what I mean? Like, if, you know, there's all these people screaming about like classism and consumerism and stuff in early punk rock, and I started thinking about how if they can scream about consumerism, I can scream about sexual abuse. And what a more powerful thing than, you know, to be a sexual abuse survivor myself and getting up and screaming the secrets that you're not supposed to tell into a microphone.
This is the all-woman band Bratmobile, recorded live at the Pop Underground Convention. Band members Molly Newman and Allison Wolf express themselves not only through their music, but also with their fanzine called Girl Germs. Fanzines are small photocopy magazines that are often written by band members and their friends. Molly says they want girls and women to feel the Girl Germs fanzine is a safe forum for expression on issues like rape, incest, abortion, and pregnancy. She says these are experiences that women endure alone, but are not supposed to talk about. Molly says she wants to break that taboo.
If you go to a rock show and you are being pushed around and thrown here and there in this hot, sweaty environment, and it can really trigger memories of things where you've been abused before, and I know these are just things that you're not really supposed to talk about because there's some kind of thing about punk rock that's punk is about slam dancing and hurting each other, and that's where kids get their aggressions out. But I don't think that that's punk. I think it's abuse, and I think that it's just some kids getting away with stuff because people aren't willing to call them on it and say, hey, this isn't cool anymore.
Both Molly Newman and Kathleen Hanna have encountered resistance as they speak out about sexism and sexual abuse. I myself found while preparing this radio piece that some men who listened to the interviews just didn't seem to understand. Sexual abuse is not just an item on some political agenda. It is something women think about and deal with on a daily basis. But Kathleen gives me some inspiration. She says for her, if one, just one 16-year-old girl reads her work and understands what she is saying, then that is the reason she does it.
Next on Earth on the Air, Sandy Nelson. She used to be an award-winning education reporter for Tacoma, Washington's leading newspaper, the Morning News Tribune.
And I am a socialist. I am a person who's out there fighting for lesbian and gay civil rights, for women's rights, for civil rights, all of the things that are very unpopular with corporate America, which my newspaper and all newspapers really, except the alternative media, represent.
When Nelson refused her employer's request that she stop her off-the-job political activities, she was taken off the beat and given a desk job. The paper claimed that readers might perceive a bias problem with her reporting. Nelson says her free speech rights are being unfairly restricted. What's more, she adds, the paper's position that reporters should appear to not have opinions is ludicrous.
Everybody is doing something in their lives. I don't know any reporters that are totally cloistered. Everybody does something. They go to a church. They may go to a church that takes in refugees from El Salvador. That's political, isn't that? Can you really worship at that church? I don't know. Kind of a conflict of interest, maybe. They might go to a church that is a fundamentalist church that is fueling a lot of the, you know, the anti-gay campaigns. So I don't think that you solve the problem of, the media's credibility by destroying the civil rights of the people who work for the media. I'm not the only person that this has happened to. I believe it is a trend. I believe it's a trend that's probably been growing since the Gulf War, because there were a lot of people that objected to the... I ran into media people at demonstrations that were there not to cover it, but to participate, and they were scared. They were scared that somebody was going to see them that knew them. They were against this war, but they were terrified. They knew that they could lose their jobs by getting out and acting as a citizen, which I think is, I mean, that's like a form of fascism. It's very frightening that this is like the, that management prerogatives have infringed into our private lives. But I've been a political activist since I was 18 years old, and for somebody to say to me, you can be a writer or a political activist, goes right to the very heart of what I am, and I don't believe that I can be cut in half. There really wasn't much of a choice for a person with my political beliefs to sit quietly and let that happen to me, any more than Rosa Parks had a choice to just quietly go to the back of the bus.
The Tacoma Morning News Tribune's publisher says Nelson's activism had gotten too visible and stands by her reassignment. But Nelson is getting broad-based support from legal and civil rights groups around the country, and she expects to one day get her beat back.
Next up, Earth on the Air's own radio drama series. Value Chicken is the creation of freelance writers Brent Hardinger and Tom Baer.
Value Chicken. Today, we find Value Chicken in a fine restaurant having a tete-a-tete with an old college chum.
Gosh, it's good to see you, Value Chicken.
Haven't seen you since those old college days.
Ziggy-zaggy, ziggy-zaggy, oi, oi, oi. So tell me, what have you been doing with yourself since college?
Oh, not much. After all, not much is expected of us featherless chickens.
I don't know. I don't think the waiter expected you to order the chicken a la king.
Well, I do like to support employments among my own kind. So, old college chum, on the phone, you said there was something you wanted to tell me.
Well, Value Chicken, I wanted you to know that I'm gay.
And I want you to know that whatever you do in your coop or your bedroom is your own personal, private matter.
Well, now, I appreciate that, Value Chicken, I really do, but see, that's the thing. Being gay just isn't what I do in my bedroom. It's who I am 24 hours a day. Imagine never being able to talk about the person you're dating or someone you're attracted to because you're worried what people might think.
I understand completely.
Still, it is incredible.
What is?
I never would have guessed that you like to dress up like a woman. Maybe Anderson, but when will you have the operation?
I don't want an operation. I'm a man. I like being a man. I like being with other men.
So, what are you doing now anyway? Wait, don't tell me. You're a florist. I saw the way you were looking at that centerpiece. Nope, I bet you're a hairdresser. And what a stylist I'm sure you are.
Actually, I'm a truck driver. I don't even know any gay people who are florists or hairdressers.
I accept you. But tell me, when did you decide to become a fairy?
When did I decide to become a fairy? Gee, Value Chicken, it sure was nice seeing you again.
Oh, you're leaving? Well, let's keep in touch. Maybe you and your one-night stand could come to dinner at my place sometime.
I'll be seeing you.
What a fine young man. Gosh, I wonder if I'll get AIDS from sharing this loaf of bread.
And so Value Chicken learns absolutely nothing at all. Still, tune in next time for another episode of... Value Chicken.
Over the past couple of decades, businesses or governmental bodies have used the court system to keep private citizens from speaking out about public policy issues, according to an ongoing government study. But recently, citizens have been learning to fight back. Strategic lawsuits against public participation, otherwise known as SLAPs, are a serious threat to one of our oldest constitutional rights, the right to petition the government. That's according to University of Denver law professor George Pring, who studied over 1,000 such cases for the National Science Foundation.
We have seen people sued hundreds of times and for millions of dollars simply for circulating a petition at a supermarket. We've seen people sued for showing up at a public government hearing and testifying. We've seen people sued for taking part in demonstrations, picketing, political rallies. We've even seen people sued simply for attending a meeting and signing up on the guest list.
Pring says the point of these suits is not to win, 80% he estimates do not, but to monopolize a defendant's money and time while a case makes its way through the courts. And without money and time, political activists often become inactive. Environmental protesters, for example, have found that direct action can get them into more hot water than they bargained for. George Shook participated in an Earth First demonstration in the summer of 1989, and he's been tied up in a punitive damage lawsuit ever since.
A couple of us sat in trees belonging to Pacific Lumber, Maxam Corporation in Northern California in the Redwoods for 5 days, and we came down, we were arrested, we were tried, we cut a deal, went to jail. It ended up for 5 days. We had a 10-day sentence. And then we were sued. And we feel that they're doing this to keep us from speaking out.
Lawsuit filers, of course, insist that their suits are legitimate. So it's not easy to simply legislate SLAPs out of existence. Counterclaims, or as the University of Denver's George Pring calls them, slapbacks, are proving to be the most effective method of making potential slappers think twice.
For a slap to work, it has to be a quick kill. It has to make your opposition melt into the woodwork with the mere threat or the mere filing of the slap. If, on the other hand, the slap targets, the victims dig in their heels, they're going to win 9 out of 10 times or more. This is no longer a low-cost or no-cost way to silence your political opposition. In fact, it can be an extremely costly maneuver that it doesn't work either way. It doesn't silence your opposition many times. It just eggs them on. And sometimes it ends up with multi-million dollar losses for you and your client. The right to petition, the right to tell your government what you think, and what you think it ought to do, is actually the oldest of all of our constitutional rights. It's older than free speech. It's older than free press. And slaps, they are an abuse of the court system to punish people for having done the very thing the First Amendment encourages them to do, namely, speak out, take part, don't be a couch potato in American politics.
George Pring studies slap lawsuits for the National Science Foundation at the University of Denver's College of Law.
This is Bonafide Public Radio, Earth on the Air. You're listening to a basement jam session. Most of the participants are recent graduates of Oberlin College in Ohio. After playing a few more tunes, Doug, Elena, Steve, Jago, and Mark talked about activism. They wondered if it did any good to have a social conscience, or if people should just concentrate on their own personal bliss instead.
There are just a lot of things working against people actually doing things that are socially conscious in some way. There's no money in it.
I've known so many people who have devoted their life to like trying to help society, and I don't feel like I feel like they've wasted their life. I don't feel like they know very much about themselves.
You can't live a life as a true believer, for me. Anyway, you have to respect yourself and know yourself and get yourself squarely on your feet before you can go out. And part of it is living in the world and making money and feeling confident about things and seeing hopefully a broad section of this society and other societies before you can go out and say, before you have the perspective to judge where you can give back.
It seems like that goal of getting yourself together and focusing on your own personality would take an entire lifetime, and that you would never get to the other things.
I would hope that it's possible to live your life as some kind of crusader, and I don't think it's a waste of time to have at any point in your life something that you feel is worth fighting for. I think there's a lot worth fighting for. I go into a forest and just some incredibly beautiful place, and then I am aware, I come to some spot and I realize that the place is being destroyed. I think that's a really worthwhile thing to fight for. I'm not fighting for that right now. Maybe I never directly will, because maybe that's not, and this is where the follow your bliss thing does come in conflict with that. I feel really strongly that things like forests and preventing our coasts from being destroyed by oil spills, and that's a really important thing to fight for, one of the things I feel most strongly about, but I also somehow don't feel like I have the specific intelligence to do anything about it, or it's a really overwhelming kind of thing.
Finally on Earth on the Air, 28-year-old Mia Boyle recently spent an afternoon with a woman who devotes her life to saving wildlife. We'll hear some of that visit in a minute, but first, Mia recorded these thoughts about her own cynicism.
Hi, I'm Mia, and I'm a cynic. I think everybody in my generation is. You see, we grew up in the 60s and 70s. Our parents were convinced they could change the world, but that all faded. To a lot of us, our society's become a mockery of itself. Savings and loan scandals, corporate takeovers, TV evangelists. You just can't take any of it seriously. But it's not that we don't care. After all, cynics are really idealists at heart. But we're just tired of constant disillusionment. Take that oil spill off the coast of the Olympic Peninsula 2 months ago. When a friend of mine told me she was going to help clean oiled birds, the cynic in me wanted to say, "What's the point?" But I had to restrain myself. I am, after all, trying to overcome my cynicism. I need to regain my faith in humanity, and for me, personally, that has something to do with how we treat our natural environment. So I decided to pay a visit to the old monastery in Bothell, where I heard there was a temporary bird rescue facility. But isn't Bothell 4 hours from the coast? These are seabirds, right? Anyway, they agreed to give me a tour and show me what rescuing a bird really entails. When I arrived, I was met by Alice Berkner, director of the International Bird Research and Rescue Center.
There are people stationed along the coast who have been trained to handle birds.
when they are collected, they're brought to what we call primary care stations, where they are checked initially for external injury. They're given fluids by stomach tube. If the birds are cold, they're put in pens with a heat lamp or some warm room. They're then transported over here.
By truck.
Hopefully
it's like a four-hour drive.
It's like a four-hour drive. Each bird has an individual record. From here, it goes into what we call the dirty bird room. This is where the birds are checked and maintained before they're chosen for washing. We keep the air going. Ventilation is extremely important to cut down on some of the diseases they can develop, much of which are due to the stress of captivity. These birds are under continual stress. This is the washing room. It was the shower room. We use a 1% solution of Dawn dishwashing liquid to clean the birds. We've tested almost every cleaning solution and method there is, and still find that for some reason or other, Dawn works out the best.
So here now, we're coming up to the what I call the Club Med for oiled birds.
We built outdoor pools for them. They spend a lot of time preening, and we'll check their blood work, which we've been doing the past 2 days. And once the blood values are within normal range and their feathers are preened back into shape and we feel they're totally waterproof, well, then they'll be released.
How many pens are here?
We have 9 pools here. The tufted puffins have their own pen. The gulls have their own pen. The sea ducks, the scoters, have their own pen. The murres can pretty well be all together.
These are tufted puffins.
They're really amazing looking.
Yeah, with the black body plumage, it almost looks like a mask.
Mm-hmm.
The little black cap with the goldy-colored tufts coming back from over the eyes, and the little white face and those huge orange beaks, which I might add can give you a tremendous nasty bite.
Before I knew it, the tour was over. The cynic in me still had questions about how much of a difference the rescue operation would ultimately make. But you know, going out there and seeing it sure beats sitting at home watching David Letterman reruns. And I made it through the whole tour without ever once thinking of Alice as a bleeding heart type. It was refreshing, and even inspiring, to see her and others like her making the effort despite what may seem like overwhelming odds.
Mia Boyle is an independent Seattle artist. She visited Alice Berkner, director of the International Bird Research and Rescue Center.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, it's your program, too. Find out how to participate in Earth on the Air.
Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. We'd be delighted to work with you.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Mention that you want program number 7.
We had additional help from Scott Bergen, Craig McDonald, Ecomedia Productions in Seattle, Susan Gleason, and Bill Svoboda. Additional music was by David Hines, Blake S. Hughes, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle, as well as KSER in Linwood, Washington. Our show is distributed by Pacifica Program Service. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.